This is Interpreting Wine host and founder Lawrence Francis welcoming you to this, my Willamette Valley Winemaker Special. Across these 20 episodes recorded in quickfire fashion in January 2020, I got to meet a broad selection of people making wine in the region, both a variety of winemaking scale from the micro to the macro, and also different focuses that include different aging vessels, different grape varieties, sparkling wines, and of course different interpretations of Pinot. Episodes are going to be released in the order that they were recorded, so you'll get to be a virtual guest on the tour. Two things you can do to help spread this series even further. One is to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, either where you're listening or on your favorite podcast platform. And the second, the one that's really going to help push this out there, is to head to interpretingwine.com/iTunes and leave a review letting me know what you think. A genuine, huge, huge thank you in advance. Today's episode of the Willamette Valley Winemaker Special features vineyard manager Dan Rinke and winemaker Morgan Beck of Johann Vineyards. Located as it is in the newly minted Van Duzer Corridor, AVA, the pair give us their origin story before talking biodynamics, permaculture principles, and what it's like working in the Van Duzer Corridor, with an especially in-depth description of the transition of the vines from conventional to biodynamic agriculture. We also taste five of their wines, a 2017 Grunewaldlinie, the 2016 Wisdom Chardonnay, the 2018 Pet Nat of Pinot Noir, before finishing with the 2016 Pinot Noir Estate and the 2016 Blaufränkisch. Enjoy!
Hi, I'm Dan Rinke. I started in wine industry working in restaurants and retail shops, and fell in love with wine while working in restaurants, and found myself working for wine distributors where I grew up in Wisconsin. I then decided to move to California and get into production. So I went to the University of Fresno in California to learn, winemaking. And right before I got there, decided to change my major into viticulture and focus more on the farming. I then from Fresno ended up working for two different wineries. The first winery I worked for, I was hired as an assistant winemaker. And so I knew viticulture from school, but then learned winemaking by apprenticing. And then my second job after that, I ended up being a viticulturalist at a winery in Santa Cruz Mountains. From there, I moved to Oregon and took the job at Johann Vineyards as the vineyard manager, running all the vineyard operations and also making the wine. And I've been here at Johann since 2007, practicing biodynamics and low input winemaking.
And I'm Morgan Beck. I, similar to Dan, also got into wine, working in restaurants and the hospitality side of things. Was always really interested in horticulture and agriculture, and that side of it kind of always piqued my interest. So I went and did a certificate program in enology and viticulture, just a quick year down in Argentina, actually. And once I got out of that, I jumped on my first winemaking internship, also in California. From there, bounced between hemispheres to try and get two different vintages in a given year and learn from as many people making wines and kind of the style that I admired and appreciated. One of those harvest experiences was up here in Oregon, and I kind of fell in love with Oregon at that point. Went back down to California though after that, and did a couple years in vineyard management. And also low input winemaking down in the Bay Area. And yeah, always kind of thought of Oregon and then made it back up here in 2015. I worked with a winery that is one of Johann's biggest fruit buyers. So I got to work with the Johann fruit over there and was really intrigued by both the smell and the activity of the fermentations, and kind of decided right at the end of harvest that I'd come over here and talk to these guys. And luckily, Dan needed some help, and I jumped in and started both vineyard and winery as Dan's assistant, and just more recently have kind of decided to divide and conquer, and I'm more in the cellar now, and Dan's out farming the grapes.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that's a really great way, and it feels like it's brought myself and the listener kind of almost right up to the door of Johann, really. And I wonder if you could give us a sense of where Johann is now, you know, where it sort of evolved to, just in sense of what is the property now? What is its sort of production? What might it be sort of known for out there in the world?
Yeah, so Johann Vineyards, I guess, technically started in 2005. Our owner, Dag Johann Sundby, purchased the property in 2005, and it's a 175-acre property total with 88 acres under vine. Originally, the first plantings were mainly Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And we planted some additional acreage in 2009, as well as began grafting some more diversity and some more varieties into the vineyard right around that time. I'll let Dan talk about the kind of farming philosophy and transitions we've had here.
Yeah, since when I started at Johann in 2007, first day I showed up here, the vineyard crew had been instructed to spray Roundup, and that was the last time that the property saw anything that was not an organic approved product. And it's been a slow evolution over time, but I jumped right in with biodynamic farming. The previous two places I had worked at were biodynamic farmed properties in California. And prior, when I was in the wholesale part of the wine industry, I sold Nicolas Jolet's wines and Michel Chapoutier wines. And Jos Meyer wines, and these are all big biodynamic people in France, and was totally in love with biodynamics and the philosophy of it. And I had some friends that were Waldorf school teachers, and so they were helping me find information on biodynamics and educating me prior to starting school, technical school on viticulture. And so as I dove into viticulture, I always tried to incorporate biodynamics in the philosophy on what I would learn. And so when I got here in 2007, we started converting to biodynamics immediately. And we were doing a more standard biodynamic program at the time, meaning that we were farming organically, relied on tillage, and right after tillage, applying the biodynamic preparations, barrel compost, and the preparation 500. And over time, I've evolved more into a farming method that's more of permadynamics. I got into permaculture, regenerative agriculture, which included no-till farming and focusing more on building the soils and having working on regenerating soils and having a higher organic matter content in the soil, a higher fungal component of the microorganisms within the soil, and really focused more on working with a system that has that emulates a natural growing system. So trying to practice biomimicry, and trying to create our soils, turn our vineyard soils to be more like where a grapevine evolved from, rather than a farm system that's maybe emulating more of a annual row crop system.
Certainly, yeah, in terms that I have a strong affiliation with, and I think I may have mentioned once or twice before, I, you know, did travel to Australia, about 8 years ago now to study permaculture, and learned a lot over there, and, you know, a lot of the things, a lot of the principles that you're talking to there, the ones that I very much hold dear. I think, maybe for some people out there, I think it would be great to give them a specific example, really, you know, because I think when we walked around, you know, a few minutes ago, you gave me what I thought was an excellent, really, you know, solid, quite practical example regarding the vines that I think, brings all of those kind of, lofty principles all together into one, you know, concrete example. So,
yeah. So, I think with the idea of doing a permadynamics idea of farming, the number one thing is to keep in mind that with diversity comes resilience. And I also think that with the impending climate change issues that are coming about, our summers are going to get hotter and drier, and we are a dry farm vineyard, and we want to continue to be a dry farm vineyard, and so these practices are going to bring that all together and allow us to continue to be a dry farm vineyard, even if our summers get hotter and drier, as I expect them to do. So I've got an experimental vineyard block. It's just under an acre. And with that block, I decided to try to make it as much as a demonstration block of how you can put how you can make a permaculture design into an existing vineyard block. And so by doing that, the first step was to move to a no-till system, which first meant, though, establishing a very diverse cover crop. Cover crop should include multiple species. Ours is over 20 different species within that cover crop. And then whatever various, so what some people would call weeds, I don't call them weeds, but native volunteers. And so establishing a diverse cover crop of multiple different types of species. So you'd have broad leaves in there, you'd have legumes in there, you'd have cereals and grasses, and flowering plants for beneficials and pollinators. Then I started interplanting other species of woody shrubs within the vine row. I have elderberry planted in there and willow. And willow has an association with two different types of mycorrhizae. There's two different types of mycorrhizae, two main types of mycorrhizae that plants have an association. For those of you that don't know what mycorrhizae is a fungus that has a symbiotic relationship with plant roots. And the plants give the fungus, the mycorrhizae, carbon, and the mycorrhizae gives the plant in exchange different types of nutrients, especially phosphorus is the main one. So plants have two different types of association with mycorrhizae. Some species have one association, the other species has the other association, and it's pretty rare that plants have both associations, but willow happens to have that. So we have a lot of oak trees that are nearby our vineyard, and they're associated with one type of mycorrhizae. And then the vines themselves have an association with a different type of mycorrhizae. And we decided to plant willows in there and elderberries in there to help connect those two populations work together. So I call the willow and the elderberry my hub species. They're much like an airport hub, where if you think of a map of all the airports around the world, there are certain airports that have many connections, where some of the smaller airports have solo connections. So if you think of that map, that's what the willow is those hub airports. And then from there, we're just working with the plants a little bit more. I have some wood chip piles, what's called Ramiel wood chip piles. In the University of Laval University in Quebec, in the late 70s, early 80s, had a research project on Ramiel wood chip piles. Basically, it was a way to take care of waste product from the lumber industry, from the deciduous lumber industry in Quebec. And what they would do is they would chip smaller branches, so branches that are like 2 inches in diameter and smaller, and chip them and put them around apple orchards. So this was specifically research for orcharding. But I've tried to adopt it into the vineyard, and I'm putting these Ramiel wood chip piles in the vine rows. And what that's doing is helping encourage the microorganisms, especially the fungus, to be a part of the system. So currently, most vineyards, most conventional vineyards or just everyday vineyards don't really have, they're a little bit too clean. They take any piece of woody material out of the vineyard. Sure, they may chip their prunings out in the vineyard, but I don't think that is emulating a natural system enough. So what we're doing is these Ramiel wood chip piles are chipped up, and then they're breaking down. And as they're breaking down in this vineyard system, they're emulating a branch that falls in a forest next to a grapevine.
It often feels like, you know, an hour is not long enough, because I'm sure, you know, as I say, with the experience I've seen, you know, an idea and a success of projects and experiments often like that, they lead to learning and they lead to other ideas, right? You know, I genuinely feel like we could, you know, stay here for all day really talking about all the different things and, you know, walking around in the vineyard and seeing these things. So yeah, we'll have to do a part two on that next time that I'm back. But yeah, I'm really excited to be here today, because so many people that I've spoken to on the trip, and, you know, this being, you know, the sort of penultimate interview that I'm doing over here, you know, all of those people that have spoken, really, yeah, right the way across the board, they mentioned the Vanduza corridor, and I feel you are both, yeah, the most qualified people that I've met to kind of really do a deep dive on that and talk to your situation here, and kind of, yeah, really kind of what that means for you, and yeah, introduce us to again that idea, and then bring it home to what it's showing up and how it's showing up in this region.
Yeah, so the Van Duzer Corridor is a big east-west gap that goes out to the ocean. It is the main gap that we see up along the coastal range. There are three of them, but this is the main one that comes into the Willamette Valley. So as the Willamette Valley heats up in the summertime, on those hot summer afternoons, it creates a heat sink and pulls the cold wind in from the ocean and cools us down. And it kind of comes in through this gap and then spreads out north-south and cools the entire valley. We just happen to be right in the mouth of it, so it gets quite windy here. I'd say, 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoons in the summers, it's like a light switch, and just all of a sudden this wind comes in and it blows until just after dusk, which summertime is, you know, 9 o'clock. So, yeah, we are recently the newest minted sub AVA in the Willamette Valley. So prior to, I guess, last year, it's been exactly a year. January 15th of 2019, we were granted the Van Duzer Corridor AVA. That was 7 years in the making. You know, it's a long process to kind of prove yourself that this is a really special place and we have a unique thing going on here. So, yeah, it's a large triangular area, kind of swath of land that sits right at the mouth where the cool winds come in. We, unlike, I'd say, most of the other AVAs in Oregon, we do not have an elevation requirement. It is more truly just about the placement right in front of this corridor. So we see, in general, specifically on warmer years, I'd say our harvest dates in terms of Pinot Noir, we start picking a week to 2 weeks behind the North Valley. It's really nice. It allows a little bit of extended time on the vine and helps us get, you know, those physically ripe grapes, but also maintain reasonable chemistry. So there are 6 bonded wineries within the AVA boundaries, which is not too many in comparison to the others, although there are a lot of different vineyards. So a lot of people are using the fruit from the Van Duzer Corridor AVA to either blend into their Willamette Valley blends to bring probably acidity and balance. And then I'd say more so, and we hope to see more as we now have our kind of own place to see these either single vineyard wines or sub-AVA listed wines. So
it was an eye-opening experience coming from California to Oregon. My first vintage was 2007, and for anybody that knows Oregon wines, they know the notorious rainy harvest that we had. Typically, we, in a very normal Oregon year, we'll begin picking at beginning of October, within the first 2 weeks of October. And in 2007, the rains decided to come the last week of September, and the rains would last 4 to 5 days, have a 2 to 3 day dry window, and then continue with the rain for 4 to 5 days, and that continued on all through October. So it was coming from California, you'd never experience that kind of rain. I think by the last grapes that we picked, we had 8 inches of rain, within that month, which is considerable for grape growing. Fortunately, the viticulture has advanced quite a bit since the Oregon of the 1980s, with vertical shoot positioned vines. We were able to get in and do some leaf pulling and allow some more airflow through. And also the weather, even though we were getting rain, it was cold rain. So as far as the temperatures were quite lower, and most of the temperatures sat at about mid-50s Fahrenheit, which didn't allow botrytis to really grow or expand or go out of control. In fact, I had some Chardonnay that in that year was unsold, so I decided to try to induce botrytis on the Chardonnay, and I couldn't get botrytis to grow at all, and it just ended up being a disaster. It was just a little bit of grapes, but it was an experiment that I thought would work because of the amount of rain we had, but since the cool temperatures, it stayed pretty clean. So that's the main problem when you're seeing rain at harvest, is the potential of botrytis, and it just never happened, and it ended up being a pretty amazing vintage. It's still one of my favorite wines that I've made, or for years I made wine here in Oregon. But yeah, just a eye-opening change from California. In being that we're at higher latitudes in California, at harvest time, our daylight hours go down quite a bit. And our temperatures drop much quicker. So the one of the things that brought me to Oregon is the ability to ripen fruit at a cooler temperatures. And so then you're able to get ripe flavors with high acidity and lower alcohols. That's the thing I really love about Oregon wines, is that you can get power with elegance. You can get full ripe flavors, but still have that real soft freshness of acidity from lower temperature ripening.
What I love most about doing these types of podcasts is that, yeah, if this were a sort of a geology only podcast, you know, we could spend all day really talking, in fascinating detail. But in theory, really, you know, these types of things, the mycorrhizae, I guess they're difficult to see. You kind of have to, know that they're there, and you need something to interpret that. And here it's the grapes and the vines and the trees, and now we can really bring all of that, what you've spoken to there, all of the philosophy, all of the situation, the Van Duzer corridor, and your own backgrounds into the wines, and we've got some wines laid out on the table here in front of us. So again, please talk us through how all of that is showing up then in what people out there can potentially go and access, which is the wines themselves.
Going to start with our Grüner Veltliner. So this is a 2017 Grüner. We're going to taste both the Grüner and the Blaufränkisch today, which both of these varieties are pretty exciting for us. We really enjoy working with them. We grafted them into the vineyard in 2010 with the first production of both of these wines in 2011. The Grüner that we're tasting right now, I think something that makes this wine unique, I mean, here in the United States, we see a lot of different examples of Grüner. A lot of the imported wine that we see, I'd say, leans towards that high acid, super focused Grüner expression. With this, we are definitely going for a more fleshy, kind of full-bodied wine. Grüner has these really thick skins, and if you press those skins super hard, they give you a lot of beautiful aromatics and texture in the wine. So we press really hard, and then we ferment and age in large format. So in puncheons, 500-liter puncheons. The wine is on the original lees for a year and goes to bottle and then hangs out in bottle for some time before we release it. Something, I guess, across the board on all of our wines here at Johann, we do all native fermentations. So both primary and secondary are native yeast and bacteria. We've never had a cultivated yeast or bacteria strain here in the cellar. That for us is a really important piece of terroir. We feel it's extremely important to use what is given on both the grapes and existing in the cellar to ferment our wine.
Part of Johann's terroir and what we see across the board from variety to variety. I mean, we have 16 different varieties of grapes. I don't really know what the breakdown is from red to whites, but the whites are show this really distinct saline quality to them. And then the reds show more of a sanguine quality to it, or a high iron flavor profile. And I think they're one in the same. They're just translated differently depending on red or white wine. But that's one thing we really notice. And another thing I notice is from time to time is a mandarin, like an orange pith or an orange quality, both in reds and whites.
So up next, we're going to taste our Wisdom Chardonnay. So Wisdom, the name, comes from our owner is from Norway. And so a few of our wines have some Norwegian names, but pretty easy to guess the translation on that. And we make two different Chardonnays. One we ferment in concrete and then age in neutral barrel. That wine we're going for a bit more precise and linear expression. With this wine, we ferment and age in barrel, so small barriques, 228 liters. The clonal material that goes into this wine are three higher acid clones that we planted in 2009 that retain acidity as we arrive at those kind of final weeks and final steps of the ripening process. So we're able to have extremely low pHs, high acid, with fully ripe skins and grapes in general. So again, on this, in some years, depending on how the fruit looks, we'll give a little bit of skin contact, usually just overnight. Then we'll press, and again, we're pressing pretty hard on our whites. We're trying to get as much out of those skins as possible. We settle overnight and then go straight down to barrel. And this wine is fermented and aged on the original lees, and it is in the barrel for almost 2 years. We feel that extended time in barrel allows the yeast to autolysize and release some of the other kind of delicious parts of Chardonnay that I feel like a shorter aging process doesn't quite get to. It allows that very pointed kind of Chardonnay flavor to move to the background, I think, and some of the other qualities to integrate into the wine. The other big piece of this wine for us is because of the beautiful chemistry, we often do not need to add any sulfur through the aging process. So the sulfur addition gets added right at bottling, which is after 2 years in barrel. We do also give a little stir in the barrel just before we rack the wine to the bottle. And you can probably see in the glass, there's just a slight haze. And we allow some of those fine lees to come to the bottle with the wine. That acts as both a natural antioxidant. I think kind of functions as if that wine continued to age from barrel in bottle. Allows it to continue to evolve, but also, you know, allows us to add a little bit less sulfur because those lees are protecting the wine. Really, the goal with this is to continue to age and evolve for a long time, and we've definitely seen that on these wines. They kind of come into their own. I mean, our current release is 2016, and it's 2019 right now, so we give it a few years before we let it go.
2020. Yeah, you're good. Feel free to say that again. Yeah, I don't want to be unfair.
Yeah, so. And it's actually 2020 right now. Yep, still a couple weeks behind in my brain.
I love it. Thank you. Yeah, you're making my life very easy for me in terms of, you know, these excellent descriptions. And yeah, I'll say it again, you know, the winemakers and the professionals I've been meeting here, they've all been so eloquent and really, yeah, connected with their land and with their wines. And I think, yeah, I don't think there are any shortcuts to that, really. I think it just speaks to people who are, yeah, spending the time out there in the vines and spending time in the vineyard and spending time in the winery and tasting and yeah, I guess drinking and enjoying and sharing these wines, you know, right the way through the process. And yeah, just, you know, in short, you know, two of my favorite white wines that I've had. And I think I'll often maybe be a bit lazy and just talk to balance. I mean, you know, there's incredible balance here, but I think, you know, these are amazing wines because they just, yeah, they almost kind of go beyond, I guess, what sometimes, you know, the sort of lighter style of white wines can do, you know, which, you know, and you can get, and I have had with Grüners, you know, where they're just trying to make a very fresh, as you say, I think you mentioned earlier, you know, very kind of acidic style. And, you know, there's, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I think both of these wines, you know, they kind of make you think as well. And there's real depth to them. But I think, yeah, the thing that I'm getting is definitely vibrancy as well, and just persistence of the taste. But at the end of the day, you know, you can use lots of words to describe the wines, but they're also just a pleasure to drink as well. Not challenging, but I think, yeah, if you go looking for more of that personality, I don't think these are going to disappoint you.
All right. This is our rosé of Pinot Noir Petiant Naturel. So we've been making this wine since 2014. We farm a block on the site, on the vineyard, specifically for this wine, and make a couple of different decisions throughout the growing season, knowing that this, the entirety of the block will be going into this wine. I think the goal for Petnat is to achieve ripe fruit flavors, but also retain as much acidity as possible. So in order to do that, specifically with Pinot Noir, we leave a couple of extra clusters per vine. I think also important to note about this block is the aspect in our vineyard. It faces north-northwest, and it's kind of down in a swale towards a creek bed. So it tends to hold the fog in a little bit later in the morning, and then just in general slow that ripening process down a bit. Like I said, the whole block goes in, so we pick about half of the block and destem the fruit. Leave that to soak, usually between 1 and 3 days, depending on the vintage. We are tasting the 2018 vintage, where anyone that knows the 2018 vintage in Oregon, we had a lot of sunshine and picked up a lot of tannin and color in all of the wines that year. So with this wine, we just left it overnight, and we ended up picking the other half of the block in the morning following, and combine the two of those in the press together. Press the juice and brought it up to tank. We allow it to kick off its native fermentation in tank, and it normally ticks through not too fast. Actually, this one went to bottle in April of 2019, so it was a long, slow ferment. And we bottle it just prior to the end of fermentation. So it's a pretty precise moment. And I think that's the most important part of Petnat, is getting that bottling date right. And yeah, we allow it to finish fermentation in bottle. We released it in June. We prefer a little drier style of Petnat, so we like to give it the time to get there before releasing it to the public. We do not disgorge, so there is a little bit of sediment in the bottle and creates a little bit of haze, but I think that allows a nice kind of creamy texture to the wine, and also allows that wine to continue to evolve in bottle. It's pretty delicious. I think we're happy with. Every year's a little bit different, but in general, it's like screams strawberry cream every year, so yeah.
It's really always, yeah, I think interesting to me to have the Petnats, because they do seem to run quite a gamut, you know, the kind of, I guess, you know, potentially due to the, I guess, the difficulty and the challenges of making them in the first place, and kind of, yeah, almost feels like trying to hit a moving target in a lot of senses, you know, not necessarily having the detail and the, again, that kind of that target you can hit more consistently, perhaps with double fermentation sparklers. maybe it kind of, yeah, it does expose the people who kind of, yeah, really know what they're doing to get that consistency kind of year after year. And this is just lovely, and, you know, totally one of my favorite pet gnats, you know, just maybe counterintuitively, you know, again, it's just a really well-made wine in and of itself. But then, yeah, adding the slight cloudiness and those bubbles just, yeah, elevates it, lifts it. And yeah, just, I think, totally makes sense for what it is. And again, to the site and to the grapes. Yeah, really nice.
All right. So we're going to taste our 2016 Pinot Noir Estate. So for us, everything that we make here at Johann comes from our estate. But this wine we call our Estate Pinot Noir because it's a blend of as many of the blocks of Pinot Noir that we can include in a given year as possible. As we pick and move through harvest in this vineyard, we pick by block as the different clones mature at different times. So everything comes into our cellar and is treated basically the same, or with the same intention. We don't have any set place for a given block or a given wine each year. We ferment with, I'd say, across the board, a pretty high percentage of whole cluster. Occasionally we'll do a destemmed lot here and there, but normally we're ranging between 25 and 100% whole cluster on each lot. The 2016 vintage that we're tasting is a little bit higher percentage whole cluster than normally ends up in this wine. Normally we're right around 30% whole cluster and 30% new oak. In 16, we had some winds change, and they came from the northeast, from the desert, and kind of within a week we saw about a 2 Brix increase, and yeah, fruit was ripe all at once, really fast, came in the door. We did a lot of whole cluster that year, a great year for stems were nice and ripe. And so this wine is right around 50% whole cluster. I think it holds it really well. And yeah, it's like I said, our flagship, an incorporation of all of the different clones of Pinot on the site. And for us, the most representative of a given year. This is my favorite wine to kind of look at a vertical of this site because it's the best one to show, yeah, what that year gave us.
Yeah, I think this is where we and I really benefit from having you both here because we can, I guess, you know, with Dan, we can talk to the kind of, yeah, since 07, this wine, you know, this sort of estate Pinot Noir is presumably being made over that time. So, yeah, maybe kind of, yeah, I guess take us back a little bit, talk a little bit to the development of this and, you know, through whatever way makes sense, be that through just, you know, how it's sort of showing up now in the bottle and in the glass, but potentially also to some of those practices that you've been, you know, you were instrumental in establishing since you arrived in 07.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I could go through a vintage by vintage commentary for you, but I think that would be a little excessive. But we can go through some generalizations. First of all, when I started here in 07, as I mentioned earlier, we started the conversion from conventional farming to organic and biodynamic farming, and 2007 did not see much of an effect from that because it was so soon. And I think prior to me getting here, there was actually some fertilization that happened, but I'm not sure. I was never told. But then then 2007's, we'll just go through the grapevines and how the grapevines dealt with that conversion. So in 07, they were fine. 08, they really freaked out. So they were completely cut off cold turkey of their chemicals. And also I moved from being irrigated to non-irrigated all at the same time, which may have not been the brightest choice. And in 2008, the vines really freaked out. Luckily, 2008 was one of the nicest growing seasons we saw. It was a pretty late start to the season. It was a real cool springtime and cool early growing season, but then throughout the season, 2008 ended up being just a stellar. What happened was we had a real stellar October. It was 60 degrees and sunny all of October. Even though the grapevines were struggling, and they were struggling quite a bit, I was starting to see defoliation because they were cut off of all their chemicals in their water. Who's seen defoliation and stunting shoots, and that same trend continued through 2009. I was seeing the same thing. 2009 was a much hotter, drier year, and so it almost exacerbated it more. 2010 it then continued, but 2010 was a real cool wet growing season. We didn't get into the upper mid 80s until August. And that was only a few times. We sat in the 70s Fahrenheit for pretty much the entire summer, mostly overcast in a fairly wet growing season, which helped with my vines that were struggling from lack of from cutting them off with irrigation and fertilizer. Although in 2010, with the way they struggled through 2009, I did decide to turn on the irrigation. And you know, you're as a farmer, you're constantly you have to react with and play with what you're given. And my philosophy wasn't dead set on being non-irrigation until a little bit later, until 2012. So I started playing then with irrigation 10 and 11, and working with some organic fertilizers beyond the biodynamic compost and biodynamic compost teas that we were applying, just to help with the nutrition, because those vines were really struggling. I really think if you look at organic certifications, they say that you need 3 years for a transition. I think it's a much, much longer time that you need for a conversion. I think it's probably closer to 7 years. 5 to 7 years is what the organic conversion should be. Unfortunately, I think if that was the rule, I don't think anybody would convert to organic. Just too long of a time. Yeah, and so then it wasn't until 2010, 2011. In 11, the vines were doing much better, but still struggling. They're still not to the point what they are today. And it was a cool, wet growing season. By 2012, I started seeing a turnaround in the vines. The vines were reacting much differently. So you're talking 5 years that you finally see the vine snapping into it. I think the soils were at that point becoming much more microbially diverse, and the vines were just doing much, much better in 2012. 2012 was a cooler year, but yet it was a pretty nice year. A little bit on the drier side. By the time we hit harvest, it was again much like 2008, where it was a real gorgeous October, and we had plenty of time for sun and cooler temperatures during ripening. And then 2013, vines were doing even better. I feel that it was probably about 2012 or 13 where the vines are finally got to the point where they're up to the standard that they are currently. The vines were just more balanced. they would hold a canopy all throughout harvest and hold their leaves would stay on well into the winter until we got a real good solid frost. Then in 2013, we also had a rainstorm that came in and we got 6 inches of rain in a weekend. So in a 3-day period, we got 6 inches of rain. And with that rainstorm was a very warm temperatures, mid 70s Fahrenheit. It was a tropical storm that actually caused several. It was a typhoon that hit Thailand in 2013. And made its way over to the Pacific, across the Pacific to Oregon, and then dropped that 6 inches of rain in the weekend. Luckily, you know, for Oregon, it wasn't as big of a deal. I mean, in Thailand, you know, they lost lives over it. We just lost grapes. So I feel fortunate that all we lost is a crop and not any lives. But it was disastrous as far as botrytis. Again, you know, you have warmer temperatures and rain. That's when botrytis happens. So that created a lighter vintage. But recently we've been opening some 13s here, and the wines are outstanding. They're so vibrant and bright and just aromatically exuberant. So it's always interesting to look retrospectively at wines vintages past and see how they can change, and also do opposite of what the narrative says that they will do. You know, you know, all these wine experts come out and say, well, 2013 is a 70 vintage. It's
yeah.
70 on a 100-point scale vintage.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden you get those wines and it's not true. And then from 2013 on, the grapevines have been doing great. They're really well balanced, with the exception of one block that I had to start an experiment with. They're very well balanced. They're reacting to the new type of farming we're doing. I easily moved into a no-till dry farm system where the grapevines are really well balanced. And then also at the onset of 2014, 14, 15, 16, 17 were hot vintages. This is what brought to my attention that climate change is truly here. They were, all of those vintages were almost a month earlier than, a normal quote unquote, Oregon vintage, if there is such thing as a normal Oregon vintage. And those vintages, were, you saw high yielding vines, warmer vintages, and in 15 and 18 you saw our two driest years on recorded history. So the least amount of rainfall from April through October, which is our growing season. And then come 2019, we kind of slid out of the what I thought was going to be climate change permanent, back into a slightly more normal Oregon vintage. We definitely dealt in 2019 dealt with some rain, but not horrible. Again, cooler temperatures with the rain. And it was slightly later than 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. The question for me is that, you know, what is the weather patterns going to be like coming up, and are we going to slide back into even more what I'd call more normal? I mean, this was still 19 was late, but it wasn't, or was earlier, but it's still later than the last couple vintages. It's kind of in between old Oregon weather and or old Oregon vintages and newer, or those 14, 15, 16 vintages.
Amazing. Yeah, I've got to say, yeah, this is truly amazing, because I think, you know, oftentimes when I've done these interviews, you know, people have spoken about, you know, going cold turkey, you know, right the way back to some of my very early interviews over in Spain, and they were like, yeah, we just cut them off cold turkey. But I thought, yeah, nobody really since has done what you've done there, which I think was incredible, you know, was actually to talk about, you know, how the vines respond to that. And I think, yeah, they're genuinely none of those points have ever been made here, you know, just around the kind of, you know, you may take, it may take longer than you anticipate, you know, three years is a rule of thumb potentially, and yeah, it depends on what's happening else outside in the environment as to, yeah, when you're gonna start sort of, yeah, getting into the mode that, again, it's lovely to bring back into the glass, because yeah, that 16, I mean, I've had a number of different, yeah, kind of equivalent estate blends and on this trip, and I think there's few that I've had that have really had that level of detail, you know, that real, you know, if you want to call it sense of place, but yeah, just so much, as I say, so much information and so much character, and, you know, getting away from something that's, you know, broader, we're really sort of zooming down and yeah, tasting all of that's happening in the vineyards, in the cellar, in the glass. Really nice.
Yeah, so 2016 Blaufränkisch, similar to the Gruner, we grafted this in 2010, with the first vintage in production was 2011. I think Dan always speaks about, when bringing a new variety into the vineyard, it's really important to keep the winemaking really simple. So the first, I don't know, I guess five years of making this wine, we did 100% destemmed fermentation, and then aged in neutral barrels for, again, a little less than 2 years. I guess it's in between 18 to 22 months in barrel. This really allows us to just see what does this grape variety do on our site, with no kind of winemaking touch on it. And in 2016, the vintage that we're trying here, this was the first vintage that we tried a little bit of stem inclusion. So we had two different fermentations of this, and one we did 100% destemmed, and one we included two-thirds, so about 60% whole cluster fermentation. We also used a once-used barrel, and the rest of them were neutral, but just kind of, you know, starting to see what does this grape do with a little bit of stems and then a little bit of wood impact, and it holds it really well. We see a lot of similarities of between the Blau and the Pinot on this site. I think the Blau has some similar fruit profiles, but almost another dimension in fruit character, and then another dimension in tannin and weight. It's, you know, for the most part, a pretty easy grape to farm, as long as we get in there and get those giant leaves pulled at the right time. The leaves are about the size of dinner plates. They're just like as big as your face. So if we get those leaves pulled early and make sure we get the spray penetration in, we're good to go. Really thick skins, lots of compelling aromatics on this wine every year. And I think a pretty, you know, the fact that it does share some similarities to the Pinot, I think as we continue to diversify and see different grape varieties on this site, but continue to see a lot of the same characteristics across the wines, show that we're starting to figure out what Johann Terroir is. And yeah, we love the Blau. We're really happy with the expression. You know, in the cooler vintages, we get a little bit more kind of floral and spice. And in those warmer vintages, we see a bit more like kind of meat and sanguine character. So it's really versatile, and I think does really well for Oregon climate.
You know, I never like to kind of force these things to sort of happen, but you know, just hearing you speak there, I'm obviously making connections back to Austria, where I had tons and tons of Blaufränkisch in my time, it grows a lot in Burgenland and Carnuntum. These are probably the two areas that are most known for Blaufränkisch, and they're very hot areas of Austria. You know, two of the hottest, I believe, and we're flipping the script here, and it's just amazing to have this, and as you say, it does have the capacity to make those very sort of representative wines in the hotter years, but you know, this feels like it's perhaps a slightly more delicate representation of Blaufränkisch than you may well get in those hotter parts of Austria, where it kind of continues to get hotter. And a lesson, really. And you kind of never know what you're going to find here in the Willamette Valley. And you know, I just think it's it feels like it's kind of bringing all of those elements and stories together in terms of we're now in that part of the Willamette Valley that you know, makes so much of the grape growing possible, you know, because of that Vanduza corridor and it's maybe opening up because of all the things that you're doing with the soil. It's opening up the site, and it's opening up the region to doing some pretty cool things, and potentially who knows what is coming. You know, with a creative set of people here, and you know, obviously lots of different grape growing cultures around the world. It's like, you know, what might be next.
So I'd like to talk about the future of Johann Vineyards, especially as the vineyards are entailed in the farming side. Right now, our biggest plans and things that I'm getting most excited about is the introduction of animals within our farming system. If you've studied biodynamics at all, or regenerative agriculture or permaculture, knowing that having a diversified farm is very important. And we do have 88 acres are planted of the 175 acres, so we have just under 100 acres, 90 acres available. Sure, we could plant some more grapes, but I'm more excited about bringing animals and putting some permanent pastures in, and being able to rotate some livestock species, especially sheep, throughout our vineyards, and then on the sides and some of the other pasture sites that we'll develop.
Cool.
And in terms of the wines, over the last, I guess, beginning in 2010 and continuing through this year, we've continued to diversify and graft in more grape varieties. So in 2017, we brought a few more of the Austrian grapes in. We planted some Saint Laurent and some Zweigelt, also some Mondus and Ribolla-Gialla, Friulano, Kerner. We did another acre of Blau, and then in 2019, we grafted in just a small amount of Sauvignon. So, in terms of what's to come in the winery, we have some really exciting things to start playing with, things that we have never worked with ourselves. We're seeing the first fruit off the vine of some of the stuff grafted in 17. And that was really, really interesting to see. They're just kind of finishing up secondary fermentation right now, and we're starting to see what they're going to look like. So it's exciting to continue to experiment and find out what is possible in Oregon. And you know, Dan and I being able to farm and make the wine here kind of as a team, it's really cool to have that opportunity, to have the space and the support to do that. So, yeah.
A huge thank you to Dan and Morgan for giving us such an in-depth exploration of the site and the region. And for all of the reasons mentioned before, well worth a visit if you happen to be in the area. Do see below for the website of Johann Vineyards and for details of their status in the UK. This being the 19th and penultimate episode of this Willamette Valley Winemaker Special, now is the perfect time to dive into the specially curated playlist and catch up on any episodes you may have missed. Available now at interpretingwine.com/WVWA. Next time on the podcast, in the last episode from Willamette Valley, in episode 399, I sit down with John Groschow of Groschow Cellars. And if you've enjoyed the series so far, one of the best ways you can help support this series getting greater play and exposure is to leave a rating and review on iTunes. Just head to interpretingwine.com/iTunes to be taken directly to the page where you can do so. And if you're not already, I would love to have you following along with me on social media, where I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, and email hello@interpretingwine.com. See you next time.